Welcome to a special edition of Directions on the News for Tuesday, December the 18th. This is Joe Francisco of Directions Media. I'm the editor-in-chief, and I'm joined by my colleagues, Adina Schitzberg, our executive editor, and Nora Parker, our senior managing editor. Today we'll feature our year in review for 2007. We'll look at the events that shaped, warped, distorted, maybe even perverted the geospatial information technology sector this year. But first, a word from our sponsor.
This podcast is brought to you by ESRI. With ArcGIS Online, you can combine ready-to-use maps, reference layers, and functional tasks with your local data to support your GIS work. Save time and benefit from on-demand GIS content. Learn more about ArcGIS Online at www.esri.com/directionsmag.
Nora, Adina, great to have everyone together today. I think that what surprised most of this year was that while geospatial technology was certainly bubbling during 2006, we never quite understood how others valued the technology. And I think in 2007, we found out. Back in March, we learned that Pitney Bowes had acquired in a merger agreement MapInfo. They were valued by Pitney Bowes at $408 million, which was about $20 a share, 50% over what the previous close of their stock price had been. So that's a nice multiple. We learned later in the year that TomTom was paying $2.5 billion for TeleAtlas, over five times its forecasted 2008 sales. And then also Navtech, which was the big kahuna for 2007, was purchased by Nokia at 8.6 times projected 2008 sales. These are high multiples. We always knew that content was king with the TeleAtlas and Navtech purchase, but these are things that were quite unexpected. From my perspective, these are values not just from our perspective of what we understand about the geospatial technology, but for those who are listening, we probably also increased in value our own careers for those who have chosen to study geospatial technology.
I'm going to jump right in and ask, well, why? Why were those multipliers so high?
I think that's a really fair question. I think from the standpoint of Nokia, they were looking at investing in information in a company that could provide them kind of a base for other applications, not just in cellular technology, not just in applications of location-based services, but they also mentioned internet applications. And they're transitioning a business from just being a hardware supplier of cell phones to, again, another information company. So they obviously saw something in the data that Navtech held to promote a lot of other different types of applications.
Well, it seems to me that it's grinding the applications down into the LBS space, and some of that multiplier in that case certainly is related to the fact that LBS applications are, at long last, getting into the hands of consumers who are willing to spend a little bit of money every month to be able to do something kind of cool.
I think another way to look at those acquisitions, and I think the Pitney Bowes one maybe falls into this category as well, is to look at the acquisition as a very horizontal buy. I think Nokia was really trying hard to say, look, we're not just buying this to do location-based services. There's a whole lot more that we can do with it across all the different offerings that we're going to have. And I think Pitney Bowes is looking at it that way. I think Yahoo has certainly made comments to us to the effect that revamping its whole mapping platform had as much to do with how it wanted to integrate it, again, across its whole enterprise rather than just for Yahoo Maps.
I think that's a fair statement. And I think what happened is that everybody took a look at this space and they said, you know, this may be part of just about everything we do. You know, we've said this for a while, but there are other things that you can do with location in that horizontal sense, and I think that's a good way to look at it. You know, we also saw a number of startups getting some attention from the press, and I'll mention specifically companies like Looped or Dodgeball. These are companies involved with social networking, mobile social communication, location-based advertising, location-based dating, traffic, car parking information. So it's a lot of these offshoot of the technology that is now grabbing people's attention that maybe even people will want to pay for these types of services. Well, let's go on. Adina, I know you've got some topics that you want to address.
I want to go back to a topic that we've discussed in the past, and this idea that data is the intel inside for GIS, having that good base map or key location information for points of interest is absolutely key. And I think what's happened this year, especially with the two acquisitions you just mentioned, TeleAtlas and NavTech, is that we're changing what we understand as what that intel inside is. I mean, sure, we still need the base map to do navigation and so forth, but there's a whole other set of players coming in. And I'm thinking of projects like OpenStreetMap for vector data, OpenAerialMap for imagery data. Those are both projects where people contribute and the data is freely available to be used however you would like. We've seen organizations like the Ordnance Survey, which has for many years kept its data very, very close to the vest, provide for the first time an API to that data in its open space interface. We're seeing consumer-type tools like Flickr and others provide access to tagging with location so that that data is now part of what I'm going to refer to as our data ecosystem. It's all changed. Before you mentioned traffic data, I made a comment that traffic is the new black recently in an article. And yeah, we sort of can't live without that kind of data, which wasn't even on our radar a few years ago. So that whole definition has changed. And I think what we're going to see are more and more players, different players coming up. I think there's a sense that TeleAtlas and NavTech are now sort of X the unknown. We don't know exactly how their data is going to continue, whether it's going to be available in the same way it was, whether the pricing structure is going to be different under new management, and so forth. So there's a whole nice shakeup going on in data.
How do you think that this plays out in terms of private acquisition of data like a NavTech and TeleAtlas versus a democratization of data where people can contribute? How do you think that's going to play out in the market, and what other applications do you think you can see coming down the line?
I think that is the question. And I think the second part of that question, and I wish I knew the answer to part one that you just posed and part two, which is how are you going to monetize that? And how are you going to check the accuracy of the contributed data?
Well, that's especially the case when with all the talk of crowdsourcing and the whole Wikipedia model.
We've got to figure out how to translate that to our world of spatial and have it be have people have a confidence in it and have it have the value such that an organization like TomTom would collect it and then put it back out, for example. So there's an awful lot of pieces to that story that aren't yet finalized, and I think we're going to have to really watch these first players out of the gate. I would argue that TomTom sort of is the first player out of the gate with its MapShare tools, where its users of its GPSs can actually update information either for themselves or to be shared back with other users. So those we're going to have to really watch how those models play out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what you're seeing is that the market is going to determine what the value is pretty quickly. With the plethora of devices in the market now, from personal nav devices, how people contribute, how people update, how people examine what that data is, I think is going to transform the market pretty quickly.
Right, and the folks from ABI just did a study, and their contention is that large part of all map and POI content will be generated by more than 50 million active members of user communities by 2012.
Mm.
So 4 or 5 years down the road, we are going to be the major contributors of geospatial content.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how the whole market reacts to that because, you know, there's so much we know and a lot of people know that crowdsourced data can be really good. But there's still quite a large segment of people out there who really aren't even ready to use MapQuest because they don't totally trust it. It's not on paper.
The one final point I'll make about that is that nobody really owns all of this yet. I mean, clearly, organizations like Nokia and TomTom are starting to acquire the data and acquire the people who collect the data. But then there's a whole other set of independent players. So down in New Zealand, Google wanted to populate its business directory for its local search. So it went to the Yellow Pages folks, and they said no. And it had to go. Google had to go to sort of the second tier folks. But the Yellow Pages folks said, no, we don't want to. We want to stay independent. We think we can do a good job on our own.
Mm-hmm.
So there are all kinds of these little organizations that are still out there trying to find their niche and make it. Facet Technologies is another one that we just wrote about recently.
Nora, let's get your perspective on some of the things you've been following.
Well, I wanted to talk about neogeography, the term. In our little corner of the globe, we get twisted up with terminology, and here we go again. This has happened over and over, terms like GIS, geospatial, you know, what works, what doesn't work. But many people recently commented on the term neogeography when it was discussed on AllPoints blog, and I thought maybe we could weigh in here. For those of you who don't know exactly what this term means, it generally refers to online mapping activities using publicly available APIs and often mashing data together to create something else. With apologies to Sean Gorman, I'm going to pick on him, and I'm going to use his comment on AllPoints blog as a starting point. I'm taking him out of context, and intentionally so, and he'd probably agree with some of these comments in the larger context. He wrote, just as the spreadsheet democratized accounting and statistical functions, neogeography will allow anyone to create a map. Well, I don't know about you guys, but I was creating maps long before I was a professional geographer. And then he goes on to say, the first maps are simple mashups, but technology and demand will inexorably incorporate other GIS functionality that is relevant and useful for the non-professional user. Neither GIS nor the professional geographer will go away, but they will no longer have a monopoly on the technology. And that just struck me because I've never really thought that we did have a monopoly on the technology. The first time I remember making a really good map was in the fifth grade. That really kind of helped me put the term in context of the bigger world of geography. So apart from the monopoly and who can make maps questions, my personal opinion is that this activity we're talking about is neither so new nor revolutionary that it deserves a term so grandiose. When you talk about the quantitative revolution, which swept the field of geography in the 1950s, and a logical outcome of that was GIS and maps and spatial data on computers, I don't think neo is the right word here. People have been making maps using whatever technology was available to them at the time and will continue to do so. So drawing a line in the sand and saying what was done in the past is old and what's being done now is new makes me a little uncomfortable. I think we're going to have a new kids on the block situation here where in a couple of years we're not going to know what to do with this term.
So how do you think that this plays out into in the world of where we're at today in publishing maps on the web, you know, getting recognition for this, you know, again, for lack of a better word, this democratization of information. We're really struggling at this point to put definitions, and it's confusing a lot of the issues.
I think geography in general is a fairly poorly understood area, and we struggle with that all the time. So this seems to be just kind of more of that. Nobody really, outside of our little field, we have a hard time with just that issue, and it relates to a bigger context beyond computers and maps. And, you know, what do you do as a geographer? It seems to be part of that bigger question.
What is it then that distinguishes what we're doing now in terms of making maps, whether they're with mashups using some of these newer tools or using more traditional GIS tools? What's the difference between that and what you did in fifth grade? What's the distinguishing characteristic?
Well, I think the distinguishing characteristic is what technology you're using to do effectively the same thing.
I think you're exactly right. I'm going to push it a little further. I think the biggest difference between the caveman maps and your fifth grade maps and the mashups that folks are doing on GeoCommons, Sean Gorman's company's site, is that they're on the Internet.
Right.
Everybody can see these maps, not like the one you had in fifth grade and not like the one on the cave wall there. That's the big difference.
Well, maybe that's a Bible thing, though, because printing is what made it possible to really share this stuff. And so we're looking at a different form of printing.
Bingo.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's it. And I think that's part of what the neo-geography world is trying to get at.
Yeah, I mean, that's a phenomenon that is the catalyst for everything that we're seeing on the web, right? I mean, the Internet was a catalyst for so many businesses, ours included. Now we're looking at specializing in map-based information. When Google came into our space, we knew that searching was going to be an element of geography or the geographic information. When you start putting a lot of information out there in KML, it's going to be searchable. You're going to be able to create your maps or explore your maps a lot more efficiently. And there you have it. There's the democratization. I hate to use the word, but there it is again, of a lot of information that we hold dear. It goes to your point, Adina, of the intel inside of data. Well, that data is now exposed. People can take what they want and make what they want. Let's go on to a topic that I wanted to talk about, and it's going to sound boring, but I'm going to spice it up a little bit. It's spatial-enabled business intelligence and the term that I refer to as convergence now. This term convergence has been dashed around for many years, but we're seeing it, I think, finally come to fruition in some strange and unusual ways. And I'll refer to a comment that was made by the CEO of Nokia. We blogged it last week. Anyway, his little ditty was, convergence is a nice dandy word, but it means industries colliding. Well, if that doesn't really go to expose exactly what we're seeing now between geospatial companies and the big guys like Microsoft and Oracle and SAP, these are companies that are now, poking at our space. We may think it's convergence, but what it really is that they are now, going back to my previous statement, they value geospatial information. They are embedding geospatial technology into their business intelligence applications. They are acquiring BI companies that have also been poking at geospatial technology, IBM recently buying Cognos, SAP buying Business Objects, Oracle, of course, bringing to market all of the things that they have been known for in terms of their application development, but the companies that they acquired, Siebel and J.D. Edwards, now spatially enabling these enterprise applications. This is really what I see in terms of convergence. These are the larger IT firms valuing geospatial technology, buying companies that are going to allow their customers to spatially enable their business applications.
Okay, I'm going to go right back to the first question I asked of your first point. Why? Why now? I mean, we've been talking about business GIS and integrating spatial into the business realm as long as we've both been in this field. Why now?
So this has been an evolutionary process in the whole pattern, right? We have seen Oracle get into this over 10 years ago with spatial enabling their database, right? Has it really taken that long? I guess I'll go back and ask the question. Has it really taken that long for people who are doing applications in financial management, in marketing, to understand the value of location? I hope not, but this is what we're seeing. This year we've seen so many of the bigger IT firms jump into this. Microsoft, spatial enabling SQL Server, that's going to come out relatively soon. We who have seen this go, oh my gosh, this is new. But it really isn't new. People have been using SQL Server to store their data for a long time, but now it's spatial enabled. So it's a fair question to ask why, but all of a sudden we seem to be raising the bar in the applications. I think the fact that Google recognized this has been pushing the mainstream IT companies. I think it's a combination of factors.
When you look at trends and phenomena, it's hard to say, okay, it's finally happening. And we've been doing that with GIS for years and years and years. And every year we see a little bit more of a baby step and a little bit more of a baby step. So I think some of what you're talking about is culminations of, as you basically alluded to, culminations of a lot of baby steps.
We've educated ourselves to the value. How did that happen? Was it because Google pushed us into recognizing the value by just putting everything out there for free, or was it something more organic?
That's a good place to swing into my next point, which is an observation that our state of education is very high, and I'll make the assertion that the state of education is high enough, and I mean this across the realm from the consumer to the student to the third-party developer, that we're very quick to frustrate, we have very high expectations, and we're going to make our decisions about new products, new data, new services very, very quickly. And I think we're seeing that happening more and more. Once people got comfortable with online mapping programs, you know, navigation sort of solutions, the first question they asked was, you know, why is my house not located in the right part of town, right? Now the questions have leapt up to a whole new level. Okay, I've made my map. I want to decide what symbols go on my map. Or I want the background to be black instead of white. Or I want to carry that around on my phone. So the jump in expectations has been quite significant. And I think you see this on the developer side of things, too. Somebody comes out with a new API, people check it out, and because most of the access to these APIs is free, if it doesn't work out, they go back to what they were using. So I think we're reacting very quickly. We're making very quick decisions because we know something new is going to come down the pike in another day or week or month.
And it's not just in the field of technology, or this particular technology. It seems to be throughout, so it's almost a big cultural question.
I think that's a fair statement. I'm certainly looking within our realm, but I think, yes, there's other forces in other technologies that are going through the same thing. Now, my question then would be, is this good for our marketplace? Does it mean that people are going to perhaps overlook something? Has this whole idea of everything being in perpetual beta sort of changed how we operate?
I'll go back to one other thing that you just stated, and it was the education of the consumer. When he looked at the position of his house on the map, he recognized that, some did at least, that maybe it wasn't in the right place. And now, if they know that it's not in the right place, what we were talking about just earlier about updating the map in the MapShare application, they may have the opportunity to do that. It's again, it's a very evolutionary process. It's these baby steps that I can contribute to changing where I want my house to be.
I think that's right on, and I think Nora's comment about baby steps is also right on.
Mm-hmm. The item that I wanted to talk about was the nav jacket, and I was kind of chuckling to myself when you talked about we're making very quick decisions about whether something's going to be useful, whether we're going to want it. And this one was one which I came very quickly down on the this is completely ridiculous end of things. So I checked out this nav jacket that O'Neill is developing. It's a jacket that is GPS enabled and will be loaded with maps of the ski area you're skiing in. You can actually see a little map on the sleeve, and it'll give you directions around the mountain. And it's being tested this year and will presumably hit the market next year unless someone comes to their senses. This is going to be a product in search of a market, I think.
Yeah, but so there may be lots of these types of devices coming down that we may chuckle at.
The jacket is a, frankly, a perfect example of convergence.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take two technologies, a high-tech jacket and a location-enabled device, and we'll put them together and see if it flies.
Mm-hmm.
And I've written for many years about the wonders of the clock radio, the epitome of convergence technology, still available at every single hotel across the planet virtually today. Because it adds, when you put those two things together, you get more than you started with.
Mm-hmm.
And we're fumbling around now to find the next clock radio. Is it the phone with the camera in it? I don't know. Is it the MP3 player that's also a GPS? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But
is
the
it
market.
Your running, is it your running shoe with the little Nike tag at the bottom of your shoe, you know, hooked up to the watch, right?
Right. And I think I give the people who came up with that jacket a lot of credit because they're trying
mm-hmm.
to bring two things together that they think will really do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when those things hit, they're going to hit big. And I think the big convergence device right now is, and this seems so silly, it's taken so long, the internet-enabled GPS device, the Dash. You know, what two things that go well together, right? You can use the device to get, it takes advantage of your location to collect information on traffic, and you can tap into the wonders of the internet to do your local searching.
Well, you know, we're seeing it on both ends, right? We're seeing it in the consumer space, and everybody is trying on the consumer space and the personal nav devices, whether you're stuffing in an MP3 Bluetooth connected to your phone. Everybody's essentially putting out a myriad of different devices out there that see which one really sticks and which one is going to cross over to either kill the iPod or support the iPod or whatever you want to think about it. But we're also seeing it at the high end, and this is what I was mentioning earlier about the enterprise applications, the business intelligence applications that are being spatially enabled. We're not sure that we really want to see a map on the BI dashboard, but it's going to be there, and we're going to see how it works. Well, that's all the time we have today. Before signing off, our sponsor, ESRI, would like you to know that they offer a variety of self-study and instructor-led training options to suit your learning style, schedule, and budget. Classes are held at U.S. learning centers across the country, with many options available over the Internet as well. Take some time before the new year arrives to check out the ESRI course catalog online to begin mapping out your 2008 training plans. For more information, visit www.esri.com/directionsmag. Lastly, I'd personally like to thank ESRI for sponsoring the vast majority of our podcast this year, and they will do so again in 2008. We appreciate their support, as we do all of our advertisers. If you'd like to contact us to comment on today's podcast, please write to us at editors@directionsmag.com. Thanks again for joining us, and be sure to tell a friend.